so much revenue, billions and billions of dollars of revenue. And yet we had the administration argue before the court that the revenue was incidental, that this is just a normal regulatory power. It's not. Nothing's normal. I do think this court, the Roberts Court, is going to strike this down, but that's in part because this court, occasionally will rule against this president. But as you note and noted at the top of this show, 24 times so far this year, this court has intervened to allow reckless and damaging actions to happen to the American people, irreparable harm to the American people. And in this instance, with the business community weighing in, perhaps it will decide against Trump this one time and then try to use that as a shield to say, look, it's fair. When in fact, this court under John Roberts has behaved in innumerable ways, in very unfair ways, in counter-constitutional ways, and in ways that have decimated our rights, including our voting rights.
So, talk about who actually brought this case. The businesses are not corporate giants. They're small and medium-sized. And when you say everyone knows that these are taxes, explain more fully who pays these tariffs. As President Trump says, we're going to get these countries to pay. That's not, in fact, who pays.
Yeah, that's not who pays. So the tariffs are tariffs on goods sold in the United States, imported in the United States, which means ultimately, whether it's businesses buying those goods as components for building products, or whether it's consumers buying things at the grocery store or at a department store, it's the American people who pays. Right now, some of the businesses that are involved in these in imports are not passing those tariffs on to the American consumers. They're waiting to see what ultimately happens in absorbing those costs. But those costs are already being passed on to the American consumers in lots of ways. And so it is this idea that this is some sort of or revenue incidental tariff, that it's supposedly foreign facing, so it doesn't affect us. That's not true. It's we, the American people, who ultimately pay the cost of those tariffs. And Congress has the power to tax, expressly in the Constitution. It's given to it, not the president. And simultaneously, in that same provision, Congress is given the power to impose tariffs. This statute that this Trump administration is hanging its hat on does not give the president the power to tariff or to tax. And there's a good reason for that. It's not just that it's in our Constitution. Trump's behavior is exactly why no president has ever been given this sort of power, because putting that power in the hands of one person allows for arbitrary, capricious, whimsical, vindictive action by one person, as we've seen Trump do. That initial round of tariffs was announced as including tariffs on Penguin Islands, but not North Korea and Russia. The tariffs are arbitrary. We're seeing sort of a shakedown process in some of the efforts to try to get countries to appease Trump's ego in exchange for dropping tariffs or limiting them. That's not how tariff policy is supposed to go. It's supposed to be passed by Congress through genuine deliberation. And more than that, because it's a tax on the American people, it has to be something that only Congress can do, because Congress has the power of the purse, not the president. And we cannot have this president, exercising all the powers basically of the legislative branch and the executive branch.
This is an exchange between Justice Elena Kagan and the Solicitor General John Sauer during oral arguments, speaking about emergency powers.
The president has to make a formal declaration of a national emergency, which subjects him to particularly intensive oversight by Congress, natural lapsing, repeated review, reports, and so forth. It says you have to consult with Congress to the maximum
I mean,
extent
you
possible.
Yourself think that the declaration of emergency is unreviewable. And even if it's not unreviewable, it's, of course, the kind of determination that this court would grant considerable deference to the president on. So that doesn't seem like much of a constraint.
But it is.
And in fact, we've had cases recently which deals with the president's emergency powers, and it turns out we're in emergencies everything all the time about like half the world.
English, please, Lisa Graves.
Well, so this question under IEPA is whether there's an emergency that's the basis for regulation or sort of an embargo. And in this instance, there isn't. The administration has claimed that the fentanyl crisis somehow allows it to impose these wide and arbitrary tariffs. It's also claimed that the trade deficit, which has been part of our, economy for decades, is some sort of national emergency. It's not. We've seen Trump assert emergencies in Portland, in Los Angeles. Like, he basically just uses the word emergency to try to get away with anything. And it is true. The Supreme Court has traditionally deferred to declarations of emergencies by presidents, but I don't think it has any obligation to defer to this president's claims of emergency, which are factless, which are baseless, and which are just another argument, the kind of argument John Sauer tends to make in justification of his client getting to do whatever he wants. So there is no genuine emergency. There is no war that is the precipitating basis for invoking IEEPA. And even if it were, it would not allow the imposition of tariffs.
So, Lisa Graves, you've written this new book. It's called Without Precedent, How Chief Justice Roberts and His Accomplices Rewrote the Constitution and Dismantled Our Rights. If you can talk more about the major points in this book, as you specifically look at Chief Justice Roberts, start with the whole issue of the Voting Rights Act. Talk about Chief Justice John Roberts' origin story.
Yes. So John Roberts chose to clerk for Bill Rehnquist, who was one of the most notorious anti-voting rights people on the Supreme Court. He, in his personal capacity, sought to make it harder for Arizonans to vote, targeting Black communities in Arizona with voter suppression himself personally in Bethune, in the neighborhood of Bethune. Then when he was on the court, right before John Roberts joined him, he issued a decision, the first decision trying to cut back Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act to say that effects would not count. So then what happened was Bill Rehnquist called Ken Starr, who was then the chief of staff for the new attorney general for Ronald Reagan, and urged him to hire John Roberts. John Roberts was hired by the Reagan administration and put in charge of voting rights. John Roberts had no experience in voting rights, no experience in litigation. The only experience he had was clerking for, basically stodging for, the most regressive justice on the Supreme Court when it came to voting rights. Rehnquist, by the way, actually urged that his justice he clerked for dissent from the Brown versus Board of Education decision. Rehnquist aided Barry Goldwater, the guy who, one of the, you know, senators who opposed the Civil Rights Act. So this is the origin story of John Roberts. He spent hundreds of hours trying to block Congress from repairing that, from overturning that ruling. And then that, the Voting Rights Act was extended for more than 20 years into 2007. And then when John Roberts became the Chief Justice of the United States in 2005, as soon as there was a case teed up for him to do so in the Shelby County case, he ruled against the Voting Rights Act. He struck down other key enforcement provisions of the Voting Rights Act, Section 4 and Section 5, that required preclearance of changes in jurisdictions that had a history of voter suppression, a history of targeting Black voters. And that Shelby County decision unleashed this wave of voter suppression and voter restriction we've seen over the past decade. And now, right now, this court, the Roberts Court, is considering overruling Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act and allowing white majority legislatures to dilute the Black vote in Louisiana and other states.
We're talking to Lisa Graves. Her new book is just out. It's called Without Precedent, How Chief Justice Roberts and His Accomplices Rewrote the Constitution and Dismantled Our Rights. As you observe this court right now, what are your biggest concerns? And how do the other justices feel about the Chief Justice?
Well, I think this court is behaving illegitimately. These emergency orders overturning the well-reasoned, factually founded, legally grounded decisions to impose temporary restraining orders in the face of unilateral extreme actions by this president, where the plaintiffs have shown irreparable harm. These are illegitimate actions by this court, basically to aid Donald Trump. And it's part two of what it did last year in effectively pardoning Donald Trump, preventing the trial around January 6th to go forward, and basically paving the way for his return to power. And now, once in power, John Roberts has helped to empower Donald Trump further with the help of his fellow Republican appointees. I think the Democratic appointees to the court in the minority are very frustrated, as you can see from the dissents in these cases, where the court is not describing why it is overturning these lower court rulings and allowing Trump to put his foot on the gas pedal to go forward with them while people are being harmed every day. I think that this Roberts Court is out of control. It's behaving arrogantly. It is aggressively intervening in those cases, just like with the immunity decision. It could have let the lower court rulings, which were based on well-grounded precedent, stand. But instead, it has sought to aid Trump at almost every turn. And in doing so, has exposed itself as a hyper-partisan court that isn't really behaving like a court, but is behaving like an arm of the MAGA Trump presidency.
What most surprised you in doing the research for your book?
Oh, my goodness. Well, it was a small thing, but, you know, everyone knows that John Roberts talked about how he was going to be a fair umpire, just calling balls and strikes. When I looked into his background, it turned out that he never played baseball in high school or college. He was actually a football player, and his coach told a right-wing dark money group that helped support his confirmation that John Roberts was particularly skilled as a tackler, as someone who studied his opponents and sought to find out ways to tackle them. That's who we really have at the helm of the Supreme Court, is a player on the field who's moving that right-wing, regressive, Reagan revolutionary agenda forward, not the fair umpire that he claimed to be and that he sought to put a plant into the American people's minds as who he is. He's not that umpire. I've actually decided to call him a Trumpire because he's been so willing to help Trump in almost every way as he expands the presidency far, far more than any other president has had such power. And in fact, that ruling really took out one of the key pillars of the checks and balances in our democracy, making the oath that John Roberts administered to Donald Trump that he would faithfully execute the law almost meaningless.
Lisa Graves, I want to thank you for being with us, director and founder of the policy research group True North Research. Her new book, Without Precedent, How Chief Justice Roberts and His Accomplices Rewrote the Constitution and Dismantled Our Rights. She was speaking to us from Superior, Wisconsin. Coming up, as the U.S. blows up another boat in the Caribbean and considers assassinating the Venezuelan president, we'll speak to Peter Kornbluh of the National Security Archive. Stay with us. Times of Love by Las Cafeteras here at our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. is continuing to blow up boats in the Caribbean Pacific despite growing international condemnation. On Thursday, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth announced the U.S. had struck a boat in the Caribbean, killing three people. He alleged they were narco-traffickers, but once again offered no proof. UN Human Rights Chief Volker Turk recently denounced the U.S. extrajudicial killings. In recent months, the U.S. has blown up 17 boats and one submarine. This comes as the New York Times reports the Trump administration is considering launching airstrikes on Venezuela or even assassinating the Venezuelan president, Nicolas Maduro. The Times reports one idea floated involves the U.S. sending Army's Delta Force or the Navy SEAL Team 6 to try to capture or kill Maduro. We're joined right now by Peter Kornbluh, senior analyst at the National Security Archive, co-author of a new piece in The Nation headlined Trump's Gunboat Diplomacy, and another piece in Foreign Policy headlined With Military Buildup Against Venezuela, U.S. Eyes Cuba as Well. Peter Kornbluh, welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you in the studio. Let's talk about the U.S. I mean, this New York Times expose, you also wrote about it. The U.S. intention to assassinate another president of another country.
That's right. It's one of the most extraordinary kind of open discussions of assassinating a foreign leader that I think we've ever experienced. It comes 50 years this month after the Church Committee, the famous Senate committee, went ahead and exposed the reality that the CIA had been going around trying to assassinate foreign leaders. And at that point, it was a scandal 50 years ago. And today, we have a situation where openly, the President of the United States and his team are trying to come up with a legal rationale for basically neutralizing, liquidating, assassinating a foreign leader, in this case, Nicolas Maduro of Venezuela. And it's an extraordinary turn of circumstances. It's something we have to talk about. The cynical interpretation of the murder of these boat crews in the Caribbean is basically that the Trump administration is sending a signal to Maduro that he is next. We are committing wanton criminal acts of assassination in the Caribbean. Innocent people haven't been found guilty of anything, and kind of setting the stage for an attack on Caracas itself in an attempt to take out its leader.
You write in the foreign policy piece about the military buildup against Venezuela with 10 naval vessels and 10,000 troops already deployed to the Caribbean, the largest military buildup there since the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis, and a carrier strike group led by the USS Gerald R. Ford taking up position. Talk about the significance of the USS Gerald R. Ford.
The USS Gerald R. Ford is the biggest aircraft carrier, most modern aircraft carrier in the world. It is described as the most lethal combat platform in the U.S. military. It is currently arriving in the Caribbean in the next 3 or 4 days to take up a position along with another 10 battleships that are already there. The USS Gerald Ford carries 5,000 Marines and seamen. It already is going to augment the military force that's in the region by another 10,000. It'll be 15,000 U.S. military personnel aimed at Venezuela. So this is a crisis. It's a crisis for Latin America. It's a crisis for the American people because there has been no provocation here. Venezuela has not threatened the United States. It has not attacked the United States. We have a preemptive effort by the President of the United States to kind of renew the old era of gunboat diplomacy and simply say, might makes right. We control what goes on in the Latin American region. We don't like Nicolas Maduro. We're going to take him out.
So Trump officials told lawmakers on Wednesday the U.S. is not currently planning to launch strikes inside Venezuela and doesn't have a legal justification that would support attacks against any land targets right now. It's unclear if they were doing that because it's right before their vote on the War Powers Act. And they were concerned that that vote is getting closer and closer and they may lose.
Right. So there was a resolution that was just voted on last night in the U.S. Senate that would apply the 1973 War Powers Act to Trump's plans for military intervention in Venezuela. That vote lost by 51-49. With, I think, 2 or 3 Republicans voting for the resolution. The resolution basically says the Constitution says that Congress must declare war for the United States to go to war. This resolution basically said the Trump administration must cease and desist its military hostilities towards Venezuela until Congress authorizes such a war. And that resolution failed, in some ways giving the Trump administration more latitude, I think, to go forward with the military plans that they may have.
And these boats that they're blowing up, that's also infuriating a number of Republicans. I mean, for example, you have Rand Paul, right, the Kentucky Republican, who's been continually raising a red flag around this. One attack after another that the defense secretary, Pete Hegseth, proudly announces. And yet not a shred of evidence are they presenting on their allegations that these people, I think the U.S. has killed, what, 70 at this point in 18 bombings in the Pacific and the Caribbean?
That is correct. 70 people. None of them found guilty of anything. None of them prosecuted for a crime. The footage you just put up on your screen of the boat being blown out of the water in smithereens is basically a snuff film. And with every attack that the United States has made over the last 2 months, they've put up one of those films and just celebrating the kind of wanton elimination of human life. And this isn't going to stop the flow of drugs into the United States. If there's supply, if there's demand, there's going to be supply. Venezuela is not a major transfer point for drugs coming into the United States. Trump has claimed it's fentanyl. If there are drugs on these boats, it's cocaine. But in the end, we don't have a situation where the law is being followed. This is wanton murder, turning the Caribbean into a killing field.
So what do you think is the goal here? We're looking at Venezuela right now. Trump is increasing his tax against the Colombian president. And then where does Cuba fit into this picture?
I think there are two issues here. One is that Donald Trump wants to be an emperor. He wants territorial gains. He wanted the Canada to become the first 51st state of the United States. He wanted to take the Panama Canal Zone. He announced that during his inauguration speech on January 20th. He looks at Latin America as, quote, our backyard, and thinks that the United States should impose its kind of will on it. He was even quoted. He told his aides back during his first term, isn't Venezuela part of the United States? I think it would be cool to invade Venezuela. So I think that's one issue. You know, an emperor needs an empire. But the other issue is Marco Rubio and his kind of need to undermine, overthrow the Cuban government. And he sees Venezuela as the key patron of Cuba. If Maduro can be eliminated in Venezuela, that will cut the economic and political ties between Venezuela and Cuba and make it easier to undermine the Cuban government.
So I want to ask you about what you just referenced, the 50th anniversary of the Church Committee Senate hearings that investigated the CIA, FBI, and National Security Agency for the first time in 1975-76. It was officially called the Select Committee to Study Governmental Operations with Respect to Intelligence Activities. At the time, the committee's chair, Democratic Senator Idaho's Frank Church, declared the CIA, quote, may have been behaving like a rogue elephant on a rampage, referring to potential illegal activities by the CIA, including plots to assassinate foreign leaders. This is Senator Church during one of the committee's hearings questioning then CIA Director William Colby.
Why did the agency prepare a shellfish toxin for which there is no practical antidote, which attacks the nervous system and brings on death very quickly?
The first part of the answer to that question, Mr. Chairman, is the fact that the L-pill, which was developed and during World War II, does take some time to work and is particularly agonizing to the subject who uses it. Some of the people who would be natural requesters of such a capability for their own protection and the protection of their fellow agents.
That was past CIA Director William Colby being questioned by the Idaho Senator Frank Church. Yeah. This is the 50th anniversary. For people who weren't even alive then, talk about its significance.
People don't remember what a scandal it was when it was revealed that the CIA had been involved in plots to assassinate Fidel Castro, that they'd been very thoroughly involved in a plot to neutralize the commander-in-chief of the Chilean Armed Forces, Rene Schneider, in 1970.
You've just returned from Chile.
Yes, I have. And the assassination of Diem in Vietnam and in Trujillo in the Dominican Republic. This was a scandal, the mid-1970s, kind of as the the war in Vietnam was ending in the United States, American public was really kind of rethinking the values and ethics of U.S. foreign policy. And the report is still very much worth reading. And at the very end of the report, the Church Committee, led by Senator Church, said, we think this is an aberration, these attacks by the CIA on trying to kill foreign leaders. We don't think this is what the American public is really all about. And we think we have to learn from this past history and go forward with a far more ethical, foreign policy. And now here we are 50 years later, openly celebrating the assassination of low-level, boat captains and crew in the Caribbean, and setting the stage and openly discussing legal rationales for assassinating the leader of Venezuela. So we've come a long way in the wrong direction since the scandal of the Church Committee report 50 years ago.
So that was the first Church Committee report.
Yes.
And then Senator Church went on to investigate the suppression and the targeting of domestic dissidents.
Yes, well, eventually the Church Committee released a set of volumes, the first true study on the secret history of the CIA and the NSA and the FBI and the other members of the intelligence community.
Peter, before we go, I want to ask you about another Peter. The trailblazing human rights attorney, Peter Weiss, has died at the age of 99, just shy of his 100th birthday. He was on the board of the Center for Constitutional Rights for nearly half a century. He worked to end South African apartheid, to end the Vietnam War, fought for nuclear disarmament, sought justice for U.S. victims of the U.S.-backed Contras in Nicaragua in the 80s, pioneered the 1789 Alien Tort Statute and human rights cases, represented the U.S. journalist, the family of human rights activist Charles Horman, in a case against Henry Kissinger and others after Horman was disappeared and killed in Chile after the U.S.-backed September 11th, 1973 coup. I wanted to play a clip of Peter years ago on Democracy Now! Talking about that case.
Our case was dismissed because we couldn't conduct discovery. When you bring any kind of case, civil or criminal, you have to look for the evidence and produce the evidence to the judge or the jury. And everything that we wanted, we were told, was classified and would not be made available to us. So eventually the case had to be dismissed.
So that was Peter Weiss. Peter Kornbluh, you knew him well.
That was the beautiful and conscientious and activist Peter Weiss. He never ceased to push for a more just system, a more equitable system, along with his extraordinary wife, Cora Weiss. They were the supporters of so many of the progressive institutions that we know today, including the Center for Constitutional Rights, which did so much incredible legal work on human rights and on trying to hold the U.S. government accountable for the atrocities that it committed around the world. There's not enough words to describe how important Peter was to the progressive movement, to human rights over these last decades, since the late 50s, early 1960s. And it's sad to say goodbye to him, but we all continue to be inspired and guided by every good deed that he did over his entire life.
Peter Kornbluh, I want to thank you for being with us, senior analyst at the National Security Archive. We'll link to your pieces in Foreign Policy and The Nation. That does it for our show. I'll be at the St. Louis International Film Festival tonight for two screenings of Steal This Story, Please, a documentary about Democracy Now! I'll be 7:30 at B&B Theaters in Creve Coeur, West Olive, 10 and Bowling, and at 9 o'clock, the second showing of Steal This Story, Please, at MX Movies and Bar. You can check out information, learn about tickets by going to democracynow.org under Speaking Events. We'll be doing the Q&A with one of the directors of the film. Happy early birthday to Diana Parra and Jenny Keenan. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting to you live from Burnaby Mountain.
Take to the skies and donate today. Help us rise higher and reach further, and donate now at cjsffunddrive.ca or by texting donate to 778-782-2573.
Hey, this is CJSF